and welcome to the reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for March 22nd, 2024. I'm your reader, Stephen Gager. Ag and environment, government and politics, justice, capital clicks. Bird drops lawsuit as EPA approves summer sale of E15 in 2025. By Clark Kaufman, March 19th, 2024. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd announced what she called, quote, a resounding victory, end quote, over the Biden administration on Tuesday as the EPA approved the year-round sale of E15 motor fuel beginning in 2025. Byrd, a Republican, said the sale of E15, a 15% ethanol blend, will provide Iowans with a cheaper and cleaner option at the gas pump next summer when the new rule takes effect. In April 2022, a group of Midwest governors that included Iowa's Kim Reynolds petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency for a rule that would allow their states to sell E15 gasoline during the summer, in addition to the previously approved fall, winter, and spring seasons. In April 2023, Byrd and Nebraska Attorney General Mike Hilgers filed a lawsuit against the EPA, challenging the agency over its failure to act on the proposal. On Tuesday, after the EPA announced it was approving the year-round sale of E15 beginning next year in the states that had requested it, Byrd said she'd be dropping the lawsuit. Monty Shaw of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association said that the EPA's decision was overdue, and he commended Reynolds and Byrd for their actions. Quote, there is no doubt that Byrd's actions spurred the decision forward at critical moments, he said. We appreciate her defending the clear rights of governors under the Clean Air Act. Now, we will continue to work with Governor Reynolds and the Iowa congressional delegation to find a solution for E15 during this summer, end quote. Quote, today's victory is a win for families and farmers across the state, Byrd said in a written statement. While the EPA dragged its feet, we fought back. Education, government, and politics. Iowa Senate sends amended version of AEA bill back to House. By Robin Opsahl, March 18, 2024. The Iowa Senate sent an amended Area Education Agency's bill back to the House for review Monday, changing the legislation to again allow schools to seek private contracts for special education services. Senate Republicans amended House File 2612 and passed it 28-22. The measure directs 90% of special education services funding for students with special needs within a district to the districts directly, who can use them to work with AEAs or other providers. The remaining 10% would go to AEAs directly in the 2025-2026 school year. Funding for general education and media services would be split, with 60% going to school districts and 40% to AEAs in the first year of implementation, and fully go to school districts in year two. The legislation also directs the Iowa Department of Education's Division of Special Education to take over oversight responsibilities currently performed internally by the AEAs. It also incorporates a lower teacher pay component than the House and Governor's proposal of a $50,000 minimum starting salary for teachers, proposing a $46,251 minimum. Senate Minority Leader Pam Yoakum, Democrat Dubuque, said her, quote, heart hurts, end quote, for families of children with disabilities over the discussion of the AEA proposed. Changes to the AEAs were highlighted as a top priority by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds at the beginning of the 2024 legislative session, who pointed to a Guidehouse consulting firm report that found Iowa spends more on special education per pupil than the national average, while some of the state's special education test scores fall below the national average. Critics of Reynolds' bill have disputed the consultant's findings on student achievement. In a House public hearing and at subcommittees on the bill, many teachers, AEA staff, and families using AEA services told lawmakers that the changes would hurt services and outcomes for students with disabilities. Democrats have said lawmakers have received thousands of emails from constituents detailing their support for and personal experiences with AEAs, asking them to not move forward with legislation allowing for private contracts. Opponents to the bill also cited results from a recent Des Moines Register Mediacom Iowa poll published in early March that found more Iowans have a favorable view of AEAs at 56% than any elected official tested in the poll. Quote, "In reading this bill, it is abundantly clear that you haven't listened," Yoakum said. "You haven't listened. I have never received so many emails in opposition to some legislation pending as I have this." But Republican supporters of the bill argued that the changes reflect what some constituents want. Senator Jesse Green, Republican Boone, read a message from a teacher criticizing AEA workers and services available in their school, who asked lawmakers not to table the bill until next year, quote, "solely because of an aggressive timeline," end quote, writing that, quote, "changes are needed now." The bill's floor manager, Senator Lynn Evans, Republican Aurelia, also said changes to AEAs have been needed for more than a decade, citing a 2011 study that recommended a, quote, "redesign," end quote, of the current AEA system to eliminate achievement gaps for students with disabilities. Senate Democrats offered an amendment calling for the bill to be stripped back to a task force to study AEAs and make recommendations to lawmakers next year on what changes should be made. Senator Molly Donahue, Democrat, Cedar Rapids, argued that the 2011 study was out of date and that a new task force was needed to address any current issues that exist with Iowa Special Education Services. Quote, "The Senate Republican proposal will not produce better services, support, or outcomes for our students," Donahue said. "Instead, the proposal creates more uncertainty for the AEA system and an unstable system for our students to learn in." The Democrats' amendment was voted down, with Evans arguing that Republicans had already taken in considerable feedback on the proposal. Quote, "We have already done extensive study on the AEA system, and recommendations have been put forward. And many of those recommendations are in the amendment that we're putting in front of people today," Evans said. Democrats argued that GOP senators were putting the governor's political interests over those of their constituents. Senator Janet Peterson, Democrat Des Moines, told Republicans to not, quote, "follow the governor off a cliff," end quote. Quote, "We have seen our governor do this time and time again with things that are actually working," Peterson said. "She has this false premise saying, subquote, it's broken, it's failing," end quote. Baloney. We all know that's baloney. It's like the governor would say, subquote, "let's just put out fire hydrants out of our communities. We can save people money," end subquote. Would that be smart? No. But that's what she's doing once again. Reynolds thanked the Senate in a news release Monday for passing the legislation, showing a, quote, "commitment to improving special education and acknowledging that the AEA system needs reform," end quote. Quote, "I now look forward to working with the House and Senate to reach a compromise that will bring transparency, accountability, and consistency to the AEA system, while most importantly improving outcomes for students with disabilities," Reynolds said. "At the same time, we must recognize the important role of teachers in the classroom by increasing minimum salaries for both starting and experienced teachers." The bill differs significantly from the House's proposal. The House bill, prior to the Senate amendment, would keep federal special education funding with AEAs, while state and property tax funding would go to school districts to then spend with the AEAs for services. School districts would be allowed to go to other providers for general education and media services beginning in the 2025-2026 school year, allowing continued use of AEAs through, quote, fee-for-service, end quote, contracts. The bill returns to the House, which can accept the Senate's changes, amend them, or insist on the House language approved earlier. Ultimately, both chambers and the governor have to agree on identical language before the bill can become law. While there has not yet been a compromise, both Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker and House Speaker Pat Grassley said in news conferences Thursday that negotiations between both chambers and the governor's office are ongoing on a path forward for the bill. Grassley said there are components of the House language that his caucus wants to ensure is in the bill to provide, quote, certainty, end quote, for special education parents, students, and school districts. Quote, "I think one thing that's positive from the standpoint of it looks like there's a willingness to want to increase the beginning teacher pay. It looks like there's a willingness to want to have some level of reform when it comes to AEAs," Grassley said. Ellipses. "It's just, obviously, what are the details and the final products going to look like? But right now, we're having some productive conversations with the other two." Ag and environment, government and politics. Bill proposing legal immunity for pesticide manufacturers advances, by Robin Opsahl, March 19, 2024. The Senate Appropriations Committee approved a bill Tuesday adding legal protections for pesticide manufacturers over failure to adequately warn consumers about the potential health risks associated with use of their products. Senate Study Bill 3188 would provide civil liability defense to pesticide manufacturers in lawsuits over adverse health impacts of products that meet the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency labeling requirements. These liability protections do not apply to Chinese state-owned companies, a move targeting Syngenta, an agriculture science and chemical company owned by the state-owned ChemChina. The legislation is supported by Bayer, the manufacturer of Roundup, a pesticide linked with development of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. In 2020, Bayer agreed to pay $10 billion to settle cancer lawsuits. In a subcommittee meeting on the bill Monday, Brad Epperle, speaking on behalf of Bayer, said the company is not able to make additional warnings outside of EPA regulations and current law. He said the bill would prevent lawsuits made on unproven bases, securing farmers' use of certain chemical tools. Quote, "There's no regulatory body in the entire world who finds this carcinogenic," Epperle said, speaking of Roundup, a glyphosate-based herbicide. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency found that it is, quote, "not likely," end quote, glyphosate is carcinogenic. But in 2022, a U.S. appeals court ordered the agency to reconsider those findings. A similar bill, Senate File 2392, failed to advance through the second final deadline earlier in March. Senator Bill Dotsler, Democrat Waterloo, criticized Republican lawmakers for bringing back the measure, pointing to the support of large agribusinesses for the measure. Bayer, as well as agriculture organizations like the Iowa Soybean Association and Iowa Corn Growers Association, were registered in support of the bill. Dotsler said that despite the EPA finding and the U.S. Drug and Food Administration approval, there are still studies showing links between glyphosate products and increased rates of cancer. Quote, "I don't think that the science has caught up yet with the real effects of some of these pesticides, and the FDA doesn't necessarily have that good track record when it comes to it," Dotsler said. The FDA has wrongly labeled products as safe in the past, Dotsler said, pointing to DDT, a chemical used as a pesticide, which was banned from the U.S. in 1972 for its negative environmental impacts. Senator Jeff Edler, Republican state senator, said multiple countries have deemed Roundup and other products using glyphosate as safe. He said the legislation and lawsuits on Roundup's potential links with cancer follow findings from the International Agency for Research on Cancer, a research body that found the chemical was, quote, "probably carcinogenic to humans," end quote. Quote, "We're trying to prevent what I'm going to call frivolous lawsuits and a loophole that has been used to sue with no cause," Edler said, "because this does not provide immunity for cause. You all know that, but we have not represented that clearly today, senators." Edler said the bill would provide farmers a tool to, quote, "keep America and Iowa's food supply abundant, safe, and efficient," end quote. The committee passed legislation in an 11-9 vote. It is now eligible for consideration by the full Senate. Education, government, and politics. Capital clicks. Bill addressing law enforcement at state universities moves ahead. By Brooklyn Drazy, March 19, 2024. A House subcommittee has passed a bill that includes protections for law enforcement at state universities and changes policies for investigations into officer misconduct and decertification. House Study Bill 738 would bar state universities from adopting or enforcing policies that would prohibit police from enforcing local, state, or municipal laws. The bill would have the Attorney General investigate complaints made against the university for violations. Laws detailing the process after a complaint has been found to be valid for local entities would be made to include Regents institutions. If the bill becomes law, state universities that have been found in civil courts to have, quote, intentionally, end quote, discouraged or barred the enforcement of laws would be denied state funds for the fiscal year in which the determination occurred, as it is with local entities. Speakers at the subcommittee meeting brought up protests and riots that took place in 2020 in the wake of George Floyd's murder at the hands of police as reason to ensure officers are able to enforce laws both on and off campus. Iowa Fraternal Order of Police Attorney Skylar Limkaman said legislation passed in 2021, known as the Back the Blue Law, included restrictions on municipalities stopping officers from enforcing the law, but left out the state universities. West Liberty police officer and former University of Iowa officer Don Strong said when he and other officers were policing protests at the University of Iowa, they were pulled away and told not to enforce the law as protesters damaged state property. Quote, "This bill has been around for 4 years, and we're trying to make sure that the region's officers have the same rights under the law to enforce both state and federal local laws," Lim Kamin said. Iowa Board of Regents Representative Keith Saunders said police were pulled off the line to protect their safety as thousands of protesters marched and spray-painted buildings. Carol Ann Jensen, another representative for the Iowa Board of Regents, said the sections of the bill requiring universities to let law enforcement enforce laws on campus and provide accommodations for officers injured on a job are redundant, and having the Attorney General handle violation complaints would create a conflict, as the Attorney General already defends universities in cases when necessary. The legislation would allow officers under administrative investigation for a filed complaint to request the incident report and any audio or video footage from the incident. It also would remove the word, quote, improper, end quote, from code when discussing decertification of officers due to, quote, serious misconduct, end quote, leaving it to be defined as illegal actions that include conviction for a felony, bribes, and excessive force, quote, in violation of the law, end quote, which would also be added in. It would also allow the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy, which handles certification of officers, to privately reprimand an officer or agency for violations. Iowa Law Enforcement Academy President Brady Carney said these changes would place additional pressures on the Academy both financially and in its work policing its own certifications, making it harder in general to police bad actors. City of Waukee lobbyist Doug Strook also brought up concerns around allowing officers to review their body camera footage and incident reports, saying a goal in interviewing an officer about an incident is to get their perspective and to learn what was going on in their mind at the time. Quote, "When you interview someone, you don't walk in and say, here's our entire case, please review this, and then we'd like to talk to you about that," Strook said. Subcommittee Chair Representative Brooke Bowden, Republican Indianola, said there's a lot of good intent put into this legislation, and that going forward, she and others will work with each other to clarify language and address concerns. Quote, "I think it's very important to protect our region's law enforcement officers equally and making sure that they have state protection," Bowden said. "This is an extensive bill that will require some more conversation, but I would like to see it move forward and for all of us to work together." The bill moves ahead to the House Ways and Means Committee. Education, Government, and Politics. Senate panel votes to use unemployment dollars for workforce programs, by Brooklyn Drazy, March 19, 2024. State unemployment funds would be used for workforce program funding if a bill approved Tuesday by the Iowa Senate Appropriations Committee becomes law. Senate File 2260 establishes a new Workforce Opportunity Fund and makes changes to work-based learning programs and student teaching requirements. As amended, the bill would strike the Unemployment Compensation Reserve Fund and transfer $30 million of it to the new Workforce Opportunity Fund, Senator Jeff Taylor, Republican Sioux Center, said, with the rest going to the Unemployment Trust Fund. Any interest on the fund will go to the Special Employment Security Contingency Fund. Dollars from the Workforce Opportunity Fund would be appropriated to Iowa Workforce Development to be used for maintenance and expansion of state workforce programs. Quote, "I would just note that the state did not make use of the reserve fund back in 2009-2010 during the Great Recession or during COVID period of 2020-21, Jeff Taylor said. "So in the end, we believe that this makes sense to transfer that money that's sitting there that's not being used." Senator Molly Donahue, Democrat Cedar Rapids, reiterated concerns about pulling unemployment funds away from their intended use in order to establish the new fund, but said other areas of the amendment made the bill better. Senator Todd Taylor, Democrat Cedar Rapids, agreed with Donahue about the unemployment funds, saying it's unclear how the funds will be used outside of the fact that they won't be used to aid in unemployment needs. Quote, "Unemployment money should really do just two things. Pay for unemployment benefits, and lower taxes on employers," Todd Taylor said. Other areas of the bill include shortening student teaching requirements for certain students with substitute teaching or paraeducator experience, expanding work-based learning opportunities to outside of the school year, and making changes to the Last Dollar Scholarship Program. Under the bill, students would need to show, through FAFSA, the Federal Student Aid Application Process, that their expected family contribution is $20,000 or less. Eligible programs for the scholarship would include those that lead to employment in 10 priority in-demand fields established by Iowa Workforce Development. These changes to the Last Dollar Scholarship Program could limit the number of students receiving aid, Senator Cindy Winkler, Democrat Davenport, said, also limiting the number of people entering high-demand fields. With the current program, the list of eligible degrees is much broader, Winkler said, adding that she's worried about how other fields could be impacted by the change if they don't make the top 10. Donahue said this bill would take control away from community colleges, which would know best what programs and careers are most needed in the communities they serve. Quote, again, this is taking local control away from our area that knows best what's needed in our areas, Donahue said. That goes for all of your areas, wherever you have a smaller college. They know best what's needed, and it would be best if they were making those decisions. Healthcare. Iowa hospital nurse charged with overdosing patients. By Clark Kaufman, March 18, 2024. An Iowa hospital nurse has pleaded not guilty to criminal charges that she deliberately overdosed patients with medications. Rachel Faith Martinez, 36, of Peterson, is charged with 6 criminal violations related to her work at Clay County's Spencer Hospital in late 2022. The charges include 2 felony counts of obtaining a prescription drug by deceit and 4 counts of wanton neglect of a dependent adult by a caretaker, a serious misdemeanor. Martinez has pleaded not guilty to each of the charges. According to prosecutors, Martinez was working as a nurse at Spencer Hospital on November 9, 2022, and was caring for a patient who was to receive hydrocodone once every 4 hours. Martinez allegedly provided the drug at 11:04 a.m., 12:39 p.m., and 3:47 p.m. The same patient was to be given tramadol once every 6 hours, although Martinez allegedly administered the drug at 7:12 a.m., 9:04 a.m., 12:33 p.m., and 1:39 p.m. In December 2022, Martinez was assigned to care for a patient being treated for an allergic reaction related to cancer treatment. Prosecutors allege that Martinez told a fellow nurse the patient was being, quote, annoying, end quote, and was using their call sign to summon assistance, and so she administered the patient an unprescribed dose of Benadryl to put them to sleep. A few weeks earlier, Martinez had been assigned a different patient who was to receive 1 dose of hydrocodone every 4 hours. According to prosecutors, she instead administered 2 doses within the 4-hour time frame and then administered Zofran, morphine, and tramadol. Quote, all of these extra narcotics with the hydrocodone would have further overdosed, end quote, the patient, prosecutors alleged. A few days before that incident, Martinez was assigned to care for a patient who was prescribed 3 milligrams of melatonin at bedtime. Martinez is accused of providing 6 milligrams. On 2 other occasions, prosecutors allege, Martinez took, for her own use, tramadol and hydrocodone prescribed for patients of the hospital. A pretrial conference in the case is scheduled for April 16th. Criminal justice and policing. Healthcare. Data suggests Iowa's Medicaid investigators are understaffed, underfunded. By Clark Kaufman, March 19, 2024. New data suggests Iowa continues to understaff and underfund the office charged with investigating Medicaid fraud and patient abuse. All 50 states have a Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, or MFCU, that is tasked with investigating abuse and neglect of Medicaid beneficiaries, as well as financial fraud perpetrated by Medicaid-funded medical providers. Like Medicaid itself, the MFCU's operations are paid for with a mix of state and federal funding. Collectively, the nation's MFCUs recover $3.35 for every tax dollar they spend, usually through civil penalties that stem from fraud investigations. A new report from the Office of Inspector General at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services says that last year, the MFCUs recovered a total of $1.2 billion for taxpayers and secured 329 convictions for patient abuse or neglect. The amount of resources each state spends on their fraud control unit generally has some correlation to the amount of money they spend on Medicaid. Historically, however, Iowa has provided far less funding for its MFCU than states with comparable Medicaid spending. According to the latest data from the National Association of Medicaid Fraud Control Units, there were five states that in 2022 had Medicaid budgets within $1.5 billion of the $8 billion spent by Iowa Medicaid that year. All of those states had MFCUs with budgets that were two to four times that of Iowa's unit. In fact, some states with far smaller Medicaid budgets than Iowa spend significantly more on their fraud control units. Indiana, for example, spent only $2.9 billion on Medicaid in 2022, according to the association, which was less than half of what Iowa spent that year. But Indiana allocated $8.4 million for its Medicaid fraud control unit, which was more than six times the $1.3 million Iowa provided for such operations. According to the association, Arkansas's total spending on Medicaid was almost identical to that of Iowa in 2022, but its MFCU budget was more than double that of Iowa's. Inspector General questions funding, staffing. The Iowa MFCU, which is housed within the Iowa Department of Inspections, Appeals, and Licensing, has a total of nine staffers in 2022, which included five investigators, according to the National Association. Only four other states in the nation had fewer total MFCU staff, and only nine had fewer investigators. In 2022, the Office of Inspector General for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reviewed the work of Iowa's MFCU and praised it for operating effectively and achieving, quote, high case outcomes, end quote. But the Inspector General also said the unit was leaving positions vacant and was not maintaining its own approved staffing levels. The, quote, low staffing levels, end quote, were partly the result of a, quote, significant turnover of investigators, end quote, which in turn contributed to high caseloads, the Inspector General stated. Iowa was spending about $759 million on Medicaid per MFCU employee at a time when only two other states in the nation were reporting a higher disparity between total Medicaid spending and spending on investigations. Federal data indicates Iowa's staffing issue dates back several years. Although Iowa's unit was approved for 11 employees in the years 2019, 2020, and 2021, it actually employed seven or eight individuals at the end of each of those years. Nearly all of the staff vacancies during that time consisted of investigator positions, the Inspector General reported, noting that while the budget had allowed for seven investigators, only four were employed there at the end of each fiscal year. The Inspector General also found that during the three-year period, six investigators had left the unit. Four of them were employed there only a short time, 1 week to 15 months, and two of those four didn't complete the six-month probationary period. Even if all of the vacant positions were filled, the Inspector General reported, the Iowa unit's staffing levels remained low compared to all other fraud control units in the nation. The staffing shortage resulted in the investigators handling as many as 20 open cases at a time, far above the unit's preferred caseload of 12 to 15 cases, the Inspector General reported. The Inspector General recommended that Iowa assess the adequacy of the unit's staffing levels and said adding more staff, quote, would ultimately enhance the unit's ability to protect the Medicaid program and its beneficiaries, end quote. The state disagreed. While it hired an additional investigator after the Inspector General's visit, it argued that its current staffing levels were sufficient. Quote, nine full-time employees are adequate at this time to operate effectively and efficiently, Dial Director Larry Johnson told the Inspector General's office. Specifically, five investigators are sufficient to respond to current referral intakes, end quote. The unit, he said, had, quote, reasonable caseloads to keep investigators working diligently, end quote, and was not, quote, using taxpayer funds to employ unnecessary personnel, end quote. The Iowa Capital Dispatch's calls to the Iowa Medicaid Fraud Control Unit were referred to the Iowa Department of Inspections, Appeals, and Licensing, which declined to comment on the data from the National Association of Medicaid Fraud Control Units or the Inspector General's recommendations other than to cite Johnson's letter. Inset box. Iowans prosecuted for abuse and fraud. Among the more recent criminal cases initiated by Iowa's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, Christina Sue Archer, 43, of Centerville, was charged last year with the misdemeanor offense of falsifying medical records. She was accused of fabricating patient treatment records in an effort to conceal 33 separate incidents in which she falsely claimed to have provided 164 hours of home health services for a Medicaid beneficiary. Archer was also charged with felony fraudulent practices for having deprived Medicaid of $8,136 through her actions. At the time she was charged, she was working for Knoxville Hospitals and Clinics, according to court records. The felony charge was dismissed, and Archer pleaded guilty to the charge of falsifying records, was fined $855, and sentenced to 2 years of probation. Bianca Beamgard, 21, of Mount Ayr, was charged in 2023 with misdemeanor dependent adult abuse through personal degradation by a caretaker. Beamgard was working in an Iowa care facility run by the company Care Initiatives when she allegedly used her phone to make a video recording of a resident covered in fecal matter and then posted the video to a social media platform. She later pleaded guilty to the charge and was fined $430 and sentenced to 1 year of probation. She received a deferred judgment in the case that will result in the conviction being expunged from public court records after the completion of probation. Jamie Lee Jenkins, 39, of Fort Madison, was charged in 2020 with felony identity theft, felony fraudulent practices, felony forgery, and misdemeanor tampering with records. She was accused of creating at least 12 claims for payment for Medicaid care that she falsely claimed to have a Medicaid beneficiary. The fraudulent billings totaled $7,000. At the time she was charged, she worked for Hope Home Care, according to court records. She pleaded guilty to the charge of fraudulent practices and was sentenced to 5 years of probation in order to pay $9,663 in restitution. The remaining charges were dismissed. You are listening to the reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for March 22, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's continue with this week's stories. Election 2024, Government and Politics, Justice. To boost Trump, GOP Attorneys General charge into battle over state election rules. By Zachary Roth, March 18, 2024. With less than 6 months before voting begins, the legal jousting over the rules for the 2024 election is already underway. And former President Donald Trump's campaign is getting support from allies who have stayed mostly under the national radar, red state attorneys general. In court filings made in recent months, these chief state legal officers have advanced a string of arguments, some strikingly far-reaching, that appear designed to lay the groundwork for Republican legal victories in the event of a contested presidential vote, or to otherwise boost Trump and the GOP. Often led by Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall, a loose coalition of Republican-led states has submitted briefs urging judges to, bullet point, throw out certain mail ballots, bullet point, weaken long-standing protections against racial discrimination in voting, bullet point, greenlight gerrymandered district maps, bullet point, and empower partisan state legislatures rather than courts to set election rules. Quote, these are all setting up an argument, potentially, to say that the 2024 election was flawed because of all these state practices that are questionable, said Paul Nolet, a political science professor at Marquette University in Milwaukee, who has written in depth on the role of state AGs. Quote, the AGs just have been critical in pushing these arguments, end quote. Marshall's office did not respond to a request to comment for the story. But last month, Marshall also led a coalition of red states in submitting an amicus brief urging the Supreme Court to pause Trump's election subversion trial tied to the events of January 6, 2021, a stance that aligned the group perfectly with the interests of the Trump campaign. And in 2020, many of these same state AGs, including Marshall, sought to have the courts overturn Trump's election loss. An election decided in the courts? The danger of outright election subversion this year appears to have receded somewhat. Election law experts have said, thanks to important federal legislation and the results of the last midterms. But the chances that the election will be contested and ultimately settled in the courts remain very high. In that scenario, advocates and experts say these Republican AGs look well-placed to provide the kinds of conservative legal arguments that could prove pivotal, both by directly influencing court decisions and by infiltrating the broader public debate. But many of these claims, democracy advocates warn, especially those that support new voting restrictions, reduce the power of minority votes, or undermine courts' authorities to set election rules could threaten fair elections. Quote, a huge part of the overall anti-democracy movement is really based on continuing to find ways to use legal tactics as a jumping-off point to spread the election denier message, said Lizzie Ulmer, Senior Vice President of Strategy and Communications for States United Democracy Center, a pro-democracy group. Quote, there are good and pro-democracy state AGs on both sides of the aisle, but the truth is there are AGs in office right now that have the potential to do real harm. And we've seen that in the past, and we're seeing it today. Growing politicization. The involvement of the Republican AGs in election cases with national stakes marks the latest step in a decades-long trend towards AGs taking on more politicized roles. In less polarized times, experts say, state AGs mostly presented as apolitical prosecutors and frequently teamed up across party lines to tackle issues of public concern. That began to shift in earnest during the George W. Bush administration, when Democratic AGs used a series of splashy lawsuits against Wall Street firms and corporate polluters, among others, to advance national policy and political goals, and to boost their own national profiles. But in the Trump era, the shift has intensified. Several close observers said a key moment came in 2017, when Republicans sought to oust then-Virginia AG Mark Herring, a Democrat, ending a long-standing custom in which neither party spent money targeting incumbent AGs of the other party. Herring ultimately won re-election, but that cycle saw record campaign spending on AG races. In Republican-led states, the politicization of AG offices reached its height around the 2020 election. Centered around the Republican Attorneys General Association, an advocacy group for Republican AGs. In the lead-up to the events of January 6, 2021, the group's fundraising arm, the Rule of Law Defense Fund, sent robocalls urging people to gather for a march to the U.S. Capitol to, quote, stop the steal, end quote, and, quote, protect the integrity of our elections, end quote. Marshall, the Alabama AG, served as chair of RLDF at the time and has said he was unaware of the robocalls. He has declined to say whether RAGA or RLDF staff were at the Capitol on January 6th. And his office has denied public records requests by the Alabama Political Reporter for his calendars covering the period. Along with other Republican AGs, Marshall sought to cast doubt on the 2020 election results, telling Newsmax not long after the vote, quote, we obviously have concerns about some of the issues, specifically of irregularities and fraud in other places, end quote. On December 10, 2020, Marshall and other Republican AGs joined Trump for a meeting at the White House. A day earlier, Marshall had announced that Alabama would join a lawsuit filed by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, seeking to overturn the results in Pennsylvania and three other states narrowly won by Joe Biden. 17 Republican-led states ultimately signed on to the Texas case. Idaho AG disagreed. One state that didn't join the lawsuit was Idaho, whose AG at the time, Republican Lawrence Wasdin, saw the Texas lawsuit as an improper attempt to use the AG's office to make policy and to interfere in other states' business. Quote, the policy-making function under both the state and federal constitutions is clearly put in the hands of the legislative branch of government, Wasdin told State's Newsroom. The AG is an executive officer and does not have those powers. That's not how we should make public policy. End quote. After 20 years in office, Wasdin lost his 2022 re-election bid in the Republican primary to former U.S. Representative Paul Labrador, a defeat Wasdin attributes to GOP voter anger at his decision not to join the Texas case. But he hasn't wavered in his view that it was the right call. Quote, if Texas can control or influence the outcome of the election in Pennsylvania, then California can influence the election in Idaho, Wasdin said. And that's not how federalism works. Labrador was elected Attorney General later that year and has signed Idaho on to several of the elections cases brought by Republican AGs. As for Marshall, in 2021, he withdrew Alabama from the bipartisan National Association of Attorneys General, saying the group had, quote, moved too far to the left, end quote. The next year, Texas, Missouri, and Montana followed suit. In 2022, Marshall declined to say, when asked under oath while testifying before Congress, that Biden was, quote, duly elected, end quote, answering only that he, quote, is the president of this country. Months later, Marshall was elected chair of RAGA, Now he's leading the charge among Republican AGs on election cases with an eye on 2024. Weakening voter protections. Marshall has battled on behalf of strict voting laws in his own state. His office energetically and successfully fought off a 2020 court challenge to an Alabama law that bars people with past convictions from casting a ballot. In that year's election, he also succeeded in getting the Supreme Court to block an effort to allow curbside voting, which voting advocates said could offer easier access for elderly and disabled voters. But it's Marshall's work on behalf of Republicans looking to influence election rules far beyond the Yellowhammer state that could have an even greater impact. In January, Marshall led a coalition of 17 red states that submitted an amicus brief supporting a bid by national Republicans to require Pennsylvania to reject mail ballots with incorrect or missing dates. In Pennsylvania's 2020 election, there were over 10,000 such ballots, and how the case is resolved could help determine the winner of this pivotal swing state. If the result is very close, Democrats have voted by mail at significantly higher rates than Republicans in recent elections. But the impact could be broader still. A district court found last year that the missing or incorrect dates are irrelevant to establishing a vote's legitimacy. That means the court ruled that under the materiality provision of civil rights law, first included in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, then extended to cover non-federal elections in the Voting Rights Act the following year, a missing or incorrect date can't be used as a reason to reject a vote. In their brief, Alabama and the other states called the district's court ruling, quote, seriously misguided. They argued that the materiality provision should be read more narrowly and doesn't bar states from imposing reasonable ballot integrity measures, and they claimed the provision contains no, quote, private right of action, end quote, meaning it can be enforced only by the U.S. Justice Department, not by the civil rights groups involved in the Pennsylvania case. By itself, making the materiality provision harder to use would likely have only a limited impact, since it hasn't been among the tools most commonly used to protect voting rights, noted Cameron Kistler, counsel at Protect Democracy, a nonpartisan democracy advocacy group. But, he said, it comes in the context of other ongoing conservative legal attacks on voting protections, including attempts to weaken the Voting Rights Act, and suggestions by the Supreme Court that it may lower the level of scrutiny it applies to voting laws that are accused of harming voters. Quote, the tools that you'd use to ensure free and fair elections are slowly being pulled away, said Kistler. When you take them all together, that's when it starts to get really problematic. Voting Rights Act. As if to prove the point, a separate amicus brief submitted in December by Marshall's office argued that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, the law's most important plank since the Supreme Court neutered Section 5 a decade ago, also contains no private right of action. Marshall and his allies were urging a federal appeals court to reverse a ruling striking down Louisiana's congressional map as a racial gerrymander under Section 2. The notion that Section 2 contains no private right of action had until recently been seen by many advocates as outlandish, but a federal judge endorsed it in a separate 2022 case involving an Arkansas redistricting plan brought by Arkansas Attorney General Tim Griffin, a Republican who has signed his state on to several of Marshall's amicus briefs. That decision was upheld on appeal in December. The issue is likely to come before the Supreme Court. A ruling for Arkansas could dramatically limit the power of the VRA to stop racial discrimination in voting. Separately, Marshall has sought to defend Alabama's own redistricting plan, in arguing that the state should not have to draw a new map with additional majority black district. His office adopted an interpretation of the VRA that, experts said, would have made it all but impossible to use for stopping racial gerrymanders. Nicholas Stephanopoulos, a prominent election law scholar at Harvard Law School, has called Alabama's approach to the question, quote, directly contrary to 40 years of precedent, end quote. The claim was too extreme even for the conservative-dominated Supreme Court, which ultimately ordered Alabama to create a new map. In response, Marshall signaled an agenda that went well beyond Alabama. Quote, there should be nothing more offensive to the people of our great state than to be sidelined in 2023 by a view of Alabama that is stuck in 1963, he said in a statement. This racial agenda is pressed by left-wing activists, not just in Alabama, but in any Republican state where it might advantage Democrats. And he compared the ruling, which aimed to empower black voters, with Jim Crow. Quote, if this brazen and divisive commandeering is permitted without even a whisper of concern from other quarters, America's congressional elections, as we know them, will never be the same, Marshall continued. We will be grouped together by race alone, with counties and cities split down the middle, the same way that we were so wrongfully segregated once before. Marshall also led a coalition of 18 GOP-led states that filed a 2021 amicus brief supporting Arizona's defense of a law requiring voters who don't sign their ballots to do so by 7 p.m. on election night. The issue may seem minor, but Marshall's brief invoked a far more fundamental question, arguing that state legislators, not the courts, are in charge of setting election rules. Quote, the U.S. Constitution is unambiguous about the right of state legislatures to determine the manner of holding elections within their respective states, wrote Marshall. Accordingly, state legislatures, not federal courts, are vested with the legal authority to determine state election laws. Court attempts to micromanage election laws duly passed by state legislatures conflict with our constitutional structure and legal precedent, end quote. When North Carolina brought a version of this claim, known as the independent state legislature theory, to the Supreme Court last year, experts warned that it could radically reshape election law, giving partisan state lawmakers almost unfettered power to make the rules. The justices ultimately rejected the argument. Why AGs enjoy influence. Advocates say it's difficult to assess whether, and to what extent, courts are swayed by amicus briefs. But they add, the role of state AGs as their state's chief legal officer gives their claims an invaluable sheen of authority. Quote, state AGs are taken seriously because of the governmental role they play in a way that parties who do not have a governmental role typically do not, said Dax Goldstein, a senior counsel at State's United Democracy Center. So there's a real difference between a sitting AG filing a brief and John Eastman filing a brief, end quote. In addition, since a 2007 Supreme Court ruling in a case where a group of states led by Massachusetts sued the George W. Bush administration's Environmental Protection Agency, states have enjoyed more power than individual plaintiffs to bring lawsuits on public policy issues. Quote, states have a greater ability to bring legal challenges than private citizens do, said Kistler. So when you have these super active state officials with a greater ability to bring cases than private parties and a judiciary that's willing to entertain the cases, it makes a difference, end quote. Nolet, the Marquette political scientist, noted that if the AG series of briefs in election cases appear coordinated, it's no accident. Quote, there's a lot of strategy that goes into planning these far-reaching arguments, Nolet said, adding that AGs of both parties use their partisan organizations, the Republican Attorney General's Association and the Democratic Attorney General's Association, to align their efforts and figure out the venues where they might have the most chance of success. Quote, it's almost like buying a lottery ticket, trying to boost the chances of those arguments taking hold somewhere, Nolet continued. And once they get one district court judge to agree with them, then it moves them to a different state of respectability. It's like, well, a federal judge has agreed with us, so this is a legitimate argument, even if it was considered totally out of there in previous years. Ralph Chapoco contributed to this report. Government and Politics. Commentary. Hardened hearts and short-sightedness at the Iowa Capitol. Iowa Republicans seek to kill effort to help poor people, but they're fine with tax breaks for big corporations that don't owe state taxes. By Ed Tibbetts, March 20th, 2024. From the Iowa Writers Collaborative. Republicans in the House hate government freebies, unless it's their corporate friends who get them. The latest evidence of this hypocrisy is the effort to kill a central Iowa program and prevent others like it that are aimed at helping poor people. LIFT is a test program in central Iowa that gives $500 per month to 110 individuals who live with at least one dependent up to the age of 25 and who have a median household income of only $24,000 a year. The program is partially funded by using federal funds awarded to the cities of Des Moines and Urbandale, and it is part of a broader effort to study the impact of providing unconditional cash to needy families in order to help them build financial security. These kinds of guaranteed income experiments are being targeted by conservatives across the country, according to a Wall Street Journal article this week. The Journal article makes clear that much of the opposition to guaranteed income programs is the belief that they're government handouts. The article quoted a Republican lawmaker from Texas opposing a guaranteed income program near Houston as, quote, wide open, no strings attached, lottery, socialism, end quote. I'll let you sort out the word salad, but you get the idea. Republicans don't like these programs because they think they're handouts, that they don't provide any greater societal value. This appears to be the view of Iowa Republicans too. Earlier this month, the Iowa House voted mostly along party lines, 55 to 43, to choke off public funding for Uplift and any program like it. The bill would require existing programs to end January 1, 2025. The Uplift program is scheduled to run through April of that year. State Representative Steve Holt, the Denison Republican who floor managed the bill, raised several objections, but mostly his critique centered on the allegation that these programs would kill Iowa's work ethic and make Iowans dependent on government. Apparently, these kinds of concerns don't apply to Iowa's corporations. Handouts for businesses abound. The state tax code is littered with handouts for Iowa businesses and corporations. Just look at the Research Activities Tax Credit, which is aimed at fostering research in the state. Over the past 14 years, Iowa has extended subsidies to the tune of more than $800 million to companies from just this one provision, much of it going to big corporations like Deere & Company and Rockwell Collins, according to Common Good Iowa, which has targeted the tax break for years. What's more, a big chunk of this money is going to companies that don't owe any state income tax. In 2023, for example, $35 million, or 42% of the overall annual total, went to businesses that didn't owe any state income tax, Common Good Iowa says, citing a state report. It's notable that, for years, while most states maintained this kind of research tax credit, Iowa was one of a minority of states that fully extended it to companies that don't owe state taxes. The legislature narrowed this handout as part of a larger bill a couple of years ago to lower corporate and individual income tax rates, but it didn't eliminate it. Americans tend to cringe at the idea of government freebies. And since the days of Ronald Reagan, right-wingers have been pretty good at turning people against trying to use government funds to help people who are in need. But that doesn't stop lawmakers, in both parties, from using federal and state tax codes to help corporations that don't need the help. It's one of the things that irritate Americans the most about taxes, at least at the federal level. A Pew Charitable Trust poll last year said 83% of Americans are bothered, quote, a lot, end quote, or, quote, some, end quote, by the feeling that corporations don't pay their fair share of taxes. What's more, it's not clear that Iowa's research and development tax break is doing us much good. Still, there is a general belief at the Capitol it is worth the cost, so it continues. However, when a local government in Iowa wants to use non-state dollars to help families, two-thirds of which are employed, according to House Democrats, and who only make a third of the median household income, State House Republicans stand in the way. Holt said programs like this are just the beginning, that they're laying the groundwork for a guaranteed income program at all levels, and that they're counterproductive. But let's be serious. This country will never support an Andrew Yang-style universal income program of $1,000 a month. It won't happen. However, some of these programs just might provide some valuable lessons for how to help get families out of poverty to put them on the road to success. There have been a number of studies about these types of income programs, yet I've seen no recent study centered on Iowa. What are they afraid they might learn? Besides, we know Iowa's poor need help, and getting people out of poverty serves a valuable public purpose. 1 in 6 Iowans weren't even making enough money to meet their basic needs in 2022, an increase from the year before, according to a new study by Common Good Iowa. We also know the state's unemployment rate is historically low. The idea that this kind of program will kill our state's work ethic is ludicrous. A $500 monthly stipend won't discourage anybody from taking a job. It's not enough money. But it might help a single mother pay for rising child care expenses that the legislature has done next to nothing to limit. And it might help some Iowans pay the bills while being forced to stay home to care for a disabled relative because the state makes people with disabilities wait for years to qualify for a Medicaid waiver to pay for basic care. And it just might help an Iowan pay for a car repair so they can get to their job. Republican legislators in the House don't want Iowans to get this kind of help, but they're happy to give a big tax break to some corporations that, next quarter, will report hundreds of millions of dollars in profits, but that won't pay a dime in state income taxes. That's not fair. This column was originally published by Ed Tibbetts along the Mississippi newsletter on Substack. It is republished here through the Iowa Writers Collaborative. Ed Tibbetts of Davenport has covered politics, government, and trends for more than three decades in the Quad Cities. A former reporter and editorial page editor for the Quad City Times, he is now a freelance journalist who publishes along the Mississippi newsletter on Substack. He is a member of the Iowa Writers Collaborative. And that does it for today's reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for March 22nd, 2024. I'm your reader, Stephen Gager. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.